Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Today we have in the studio a legitimate supergroup who made a great album I'm pretty excited about. They are Prophets of Rage, and there are so many of them that I'm just going to ask them to go around and say hello individually and say who they are.
My name is Tom Morello, the guitarist for Prophets of Rage.
I am B-Real, member of Prophets of Rage.
Member.
I am Chuck D, microphone number two.
Brad Wilk, beats.
DJ Lord, turntablist.
Timmy C, bass.
And enforcer.
Ray Lewis.
The Ray Lewis of bass.
So, Chuck, I might start with you. What was it like to first stand in front of this group and fuel this particular live band power? You've obviously fronted live bands before, been in all sorts of configurations, but I mean, this is the core of the Rage rhythm section and more. It's a particular power. What did it feel like, and how does it affect the way you perform with them?
Well, number one, I'm the weakest link out of this bunch.
That's a lie. Come on, liar.
No, I am. But that's good. That's good. Because if I'm a weak link, everybody's in trouble trying to follow up on stage. Number two, me and Thomas we've had arm wrestling, you know, over the fact that we're a super group or we're not a super group. We are a super group. And
Chuck embraces the term.
Yeah, I embrace it. And I've heard people or groups or situations call themselves super groups before, but I'm like, they're not even transcendent. They don't transcend their genre. Mm. And I think each one of the members here do.
What does it feel like, and how does it affect the way you perform when you're backed by this powerhouse here?
Well, number one, you got to bring it.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get swallowed, and B knows right here, you could get swallowed up in it. Number one, if you don't prepare, if you don't train. And then, you know, Tom is the Michael Jordan, Phil Jackson of rehearsals. So by the time we get to the show, B will tell you the rest.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the one thing is that we're all fan of each other, you know, of each other's music and whatnot, and we appreciate everything we've all done individually. So coming together, you know, the enthusiasm, I think, just translated into the vibe, you know, where Chuck and I figured out how to piece Zach's stuff together where it worked out for us and what we're trying to do here to make it sound the best as possible, best possible representation of the song right now between us, you know. And in that, we found ways that we can work together on new songs and flip it back and forth a la like the Run DMC style.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And you know, because Chuck and I come from groups that have that component of a high low combination of vocal tones, him with Flav, you know, the high and the low, and myself with Sendog, the high and low. It was a natural, you know, chemistry between his voice and my voice being the high and the low. And, you know, either one of us can take lead on any one of these songs, you know, be it the Rage songs or the new songs, you know. And it's amazing to have that type of, you know, skill set right there, you know, between the rhythm section and us as the MCs, you know, representing the classic songs and bringing on these new songs. There has to be an energy about it. There has to be, you know, that driving force that was in those classic songs. So fortunately, you know, Chuck and I figured out how to make that work with what we're doing today. And it blows me away to hear some of the stuff sometimes, you know, when we're in rehearsal and hearing how we're presenting the old songs and then the energy of the new songs and how they stand next to each other. I mean, it's quite an amazing feeling.
I guess this is for both B and Chuck. Learning those Zach vocals, learning those Zach raps, what did you learn about him and how his style fit in with this band and how it compares to the way you do it on your own, and how did all that work kind of assimilating that?
Don't try to repeat him. Uh-huh. You can't repeat the dude that's in his 20s that sound like a knife is turning in him. and passionate and very convicted with every single syllable.
You know, I can say this. I was a very big fan of Public Enemy. You know, Run DMC and Public Enemy were my two favorite groups of all time. So I studied pockets of you know, rhymes and where they fall into the beats and stuff like that, right? And so I've been a big Chuck D fan. style is unorthodox in comparison to many other rappers out there and very forceful. Now, when I heard Rage Against the Machine, I heard Chuck's influence on Zach and his vocal,
yeah,
you know, where he takes it stylistically and even some of the context and some of the things he was saying and how he was saying it in the cadence. It was very Chuck D style and wrapped with his own spin on it, of course, you know, because he was very aggressive in the vocals and it was a mixture of Chuck D style mixed with a little bit of punk element to it, right? So for me, being a fan of Chuck D and being a fan of Zach together, it gave me like the template on where I had to be.
Yeah.
And it made it easy for me because, you know, I can get in sort of the same tones that Zach was at, but the punk style is a little different for me. So I had to sort of figure out how I was going to work that into it. But I knew that, you know, Chuck and I could take this task on because, you know, it's basically Chuck fitting into a style that was derived from influence of Chuck. You know what I mean?
That's a great point, of course.
And,
yeah.
You know, it just all came together, you know, really well. And what that helped, I think, was to come into the new stuff, you know, to know those different pockets, know those different deliveries that normally as a hip hop rapper, I don't necessarily deliver the same way. But studying the Rage Against the Machine songs and performing them with these gentlemen, it gave me a new skill set into going into what Prophets of Rage would later record as a band, you know. So I learned a lot pretty much from doing all this, you know, with these guys, and that was my end of it pretty much.
One of the cool things about this group is the DJ Lord's presence, because, you know, obviously one of Tom's claims to fame is being a guitarist who was influenced by hip hop DJs, including Terminator X and a lot of the cool things that DJs do, and now you have an actual DJ in your band.
Yes.
So how does that work though? Because the DJ shit that you might want to do can be done by the DJ. So how do you figure it out?
Well, I've been doing a lot of DJ shit for years, so yeah. I'm ready to relinquish some of that. But one of the highlights of the show and on the record is we do a DJ battle between myself and Lord, and that allows for something that, you know, there's no other band in the history of bands has been able to do that. And so it's really fun every night, and it's a real highlight on the record on a song called Hail to the Chief, where we did it on record. And you can, you know, one of us is in one headphone, the other's in the other, and you decide which is the guitar and which is the turntables.
And let's hear a little bit of that part of Hail to the Chief right now.
Nice.
It's amazing. We've been chasing this guy for eons. I've been chasing this guy in the turntables for eons. And even in an interview for Sure Needles back in my battle days, they would say, if you were to battle a DJ, who would you battle? What's your ultimate battle? I said, Tom Morello. It's printed. So to actually be involved in that, it's pretty epic for me.
Hey, there's power in saying things out loud, man.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And for us, one of the challenges for Tim and Brad and I, who had never played with a DJ before and had a very kind of well-oiled way of making impactful music, and some of our, you know, before this band ever played a show, we spent months secretly rehearsing deep in the San Fernando Valley,
wow,
trying to get it right, because there was, you know, on paper it looks great. But we're like, okay, there's a D at first, you know, the first couple attempts, like, because Public Enemy does it a very different way when they mix a live band with the thing, and that way didn't work with us. And we tried a bunch of different ways to work until we finally finally sort of honed, and you know, DJ Lord is a crucial part of both the record and the show, where, you know, our whole show starts with a DJ Lord set, where here's the thing about some rock fans may not know, but the hip hop component of the band, DJ Lord, Chuck D, and Be Real, are huge fans of rock and roll and have a depth and breadth of knowledge of rock music. The original PE stage show was modeled on the Iron Maiden stage show. Be Real has he likes metal that's so much harder than the metal I like. I don't like the metal that he likes, right? You know, and DJ Lord is the only one in the band that actually knows all of the words to all three of the band songs. So
Rolodex.
Yeah. But anyways, first, I mean, one thing that sort of bears mention, we're talking about sort of specifics, but like to pull the camera back, as you guys know who we are. Sometimes I find, like, even on a daily basis with fans of Rage, that they don't know what the hell this thing is. Prophets of Rage is a band with three of the dudes from Rage Against the Machine, myself, Tim, and Brad, two of the dudes from Public Enemy, Chuck D and DJ Lord, and Be Real from Cypress Hill. Record out on September 15th. That's sort of the factual stuff. Now let's get back to your thoughtful question.
We are the pyramid.
That was your most Gene Simmons moment.
Yeah.
That was Gene Simmons.
Look, I've been doing a lot of, it's nice to do interviews, but you want to know the record's out on September 15th too.
Set Master, I mean, I'll Skinny T.
I'll go down to 7B. You buy me a drink, I'll talk about this all night long.
Skinny T, ladies. Ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. Those guitar picks aren't going to buy themselves.
More big picture thinking. Tom, you had, I believe, the original sort of germ of thought of doing this thing. Trace us through kind of the thinking of how this came together.
Sure. I mean, it was very simple. It was during the 2016 election, and I saw on TV, it said, Donald Trump rages against the machine. And I was so outraged, I tweeted about it. And then I thought, that's a fool thing to do. And this is going to require more than hashtags to combat the, you know, impending storm. And, you know, called up some friends. And it was basically, you know, put your hand in the air if you want to fight the power and bring the noise and change the world right now. And these six hands went up, so.
It's kind of a stroke of genius to have B and Chuck. In fact, the only people I can really imagine doing this.
It's called good casting.
Yeah. Casting. So what was that process?
They were the, you know, once Tim and Brad and I were, they were the hip hop inspirations for Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
You know, like when we were making that first Rage record, there were two primary cassettes that were around. One was Soundgarden's Bad Motorfinger. The other was the first Cypress Hill record. You listen to those two records at the same time, and it sounds like the Rage Against the Machine record, right? And you know, and Public Enemy, of course, is the pillar of political power, wisdom, and revolutionary knowledge and soundscape in all of our lives. So those were the obvious choices. And Chuck was a bit of a reluctant bride initially and took a little arm twisting to come around. But and then when B joined the fold, we became Prophets of Rage properly.
And he just called Chuck a bride. That ain't gonna bode well. I'll tell you that right now.
Chuck, why were you a reluctant groom?
I was smack dab initially. Well, Tom had kind of like hinted at it even for like close to a year, but then November he hinted a little heavily uppercase. And I was juggling a tour with the Prodigy. Public Enemy was like on the 105th tour, and I was like, well, you know, my hands are full. And then Tom, you know, had a conversation, an academic conversation. He from Harvard, my wife a professor. And then she said, you know, like, you be who you are, you are who you are. Go do this. So that, and then my father passed February 8th, and then I was like, well, nothing's going to stop me from doing anything now. So that's what happened after that. And it's academic from there.
Mm. Tell me about the very first kind of meeting and rehearsal that you guys had.
What's that button on the game show that goes,
That was the theme music for that first rehearsal.
I remember the first rehearsal being kind of a disaster. Disaster is maybe a disaster, lowercase d. Brad, tell us about the first rehearsal.
I don't know, just a bit of a head scratcher.
Yeah.
Us three hadn't played in a long time.
Yes.
Again, we weren't sure how to incorporate everything that we were doing.
Yeah.
We were playing to records and we were not playing to records. Yeah. And it was like, what's
confusing.
How are we going to do this? That was kind of the beauty of it. We all knew, I mean, I knew I was in a room with the greatest people of all time on their prospective instruments. And like, shit, I hope the chemistry eventually finds itself. And it did.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ingredients were there, but it took a while to. And you know who had booked a show at the first time we ever played was at the Whiskey on May 31st, 2016. And that show was coming up. And so we'd been, you know, in the lab very sort of scientifically trying to put this together. And it really it took a while. Like it really was sort of coming together. And then the first time I felt this is going to be fucking great was 3 days before the show. Shepard Fairey, who did, you know, has done artwork for us, came down, and it was the first time we had an audience of one. And it changed the whole thing, because we were no longer trying to remember the songs, playing for each other, talking about parts. Even with one person in the room, it became a performance.
Yeah.
And the decades of knowing how to rock people and move, you know, like, and it projected out for the first time rather than inward for the first time. And, you know, Shepard just sitting there going, oh shit. Like, I'm thinking, oh shit, yeah.
Oh, shit.
It's going to be all right.
That's a good, oh shit.
Well, I got it. I got it. For me, you know, when Tom called me and says, Chuck, what do you think about, and he hesitated, which is un-Tom like, what do you think about, you know, how would you feel if Be Real was invited to, and I was like, yes. And that's when it crystallized in my mind, because then I said, well, I know what my role could be, and I know what this man is going to bring to the table, and I really see that happening. And wants to be real. And my fingers were crossed. And I was like telling Tom, I just hope he does. I mean, and my mind, for some reason, B, I was like, well, B's going, I'm busy. He's going to give him the same lame ass excuse I gave for the past year. And we got to wait for another year. But when Be Real said he was in, I was like, you know, then it was, oh shit, this shit on paper is a motherfucker. Then it was to climb that mountain.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden it looked like the six-headed, you know, Mount Rushmore of molten rap rock, you know? Yeah. And everybody, and the thing's like, everybody, Chuck's right, everybody does have a role. Like, Be Real, Dr. Green Thumb is the shaman who has continued to evolve, you know, from his role of like, from his Cypress Hill excellence as street poetry and legalization, you know, fighting for legalization, to like the master of ceremonies of a potent political band. You know, Chuck D brings all the gravitas of the hard rhymer. He is the rhyme animal, and he is second to none. He's all four heads on the Mount Rushmore of that. You know what I mean? Brad Wilk is the field is the field bouncing field general. Like, if you want a beat that's going to make 100,000 people jump up and down, there's one. And you want to rank them?
War drums.
He's the first four.
The okay? God of hard drums.
That's the war four. Drums right there. Wow.
And, you know, DJ Lord is the as a turntablist with turntables as an instrument, he is without peer. And the, like, he's the, I'd say the one of the very few musicians I've ever been in a room with where I just go, I have no fucking clue what that guy is doing, and I don't want to know. Like, I don't, like, normally I'm like, oh, so what do you, you know, is that a C minor triad? Like, I don't know. I have no idea even where it starts or begins. And then Timmy C is the enforcer, and the power of his bass and the power of his stance and the power of his steely glare is reflected in every note that he plays, and he's deadly serious, and he wants to win. Yes. He doesn't want to win every show, he wants to win every note that he plays.
Yep.
And that is reflected.
We call him Iron Calves.
Yep.
And he bounces like, you know, flawless and effortless.
And the spiritual soul.
Better than I could say it.
Yeah. He's a spiritual soul, man. That instrument plays him. I mean, seriously.
So I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. We're talking to the supergroup Prophets of Rage, who have their first album out on September 15th, and we'll be right back with a lot more.
I Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
Judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
So we were talking a little bit about the formation of the group, and now we're going to go to the album itself, because at first you were essentially a very excellent cover band. Of course, I'm joking, but you were, but
we've read a lot. It's like a karaoke. How the fuck, man? It's like, come on, these are our songs.
I mean, the good. You have a question coming, but the good news is like I would anticipate. Like if I heard that three bands that I was interested in got together, I would be like, oh, real? Let's see what that is. And that there's nothing heightens your, at least for us, for competitive musicians like ourselves, kind of heightens your self-awareness and your desire to kill it, like that sort of chip on your shoulder. Yep. And we're like, great. You know what we do after the show? We drink haters' tears. Yeah.
On ice.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what. We knew we were going to get met with skepticism all over the place. You know what I mean? But
the whole
intent was to play these songs that no one had heard in a long time that needed to be heard now in this time with everything going on, along with the Public Enemy and Cypress Hill catalog, you know, and knowing that we were going to get this skepticism, you know, the one thing that we wanted everyone to know and feel was that we are a band, and it's going to go beyond what we were playing initially, which pretty much compelled us to make an album and bring forth our own sound, our own message, inspired by Rage Against the Machine, Public Enemy, and Cypress Hill. You know, it just so happens that we came together for a great reason, I think, a great cause, and we found ourselves, who we are, as Prophets of Rage, in that time when we were just getting together and playing these songs that we've known forever. You know, now we're venturing into a new place with new music, and we're as confident with that music as we are with our back catalog and stuff like that. So, you know, exactly, you know, haters' tears on ice with
you
the
have
splash.
And what an amazing like launching pad it is for us, because before our first record came out as a band, Prophets of Rage have played three continents in front of over 2.5 million people. You know, so like that we've got that amount of shows under our belt before we even start the tour for our first record.
Well, what was the kind of key first track when your original started to come together? What was the from the stuff on the album?
As far as the new stuff.
Yeah, new stuff, yeah.
I believe it was Smash It.
Smash It was the first song that kind of like mulled around before we sat down to write songs. That was kind of in the rehearsals. But it was a very kind of loose, the first day of rehearsal, we had a plan. We're going to write two songs today. Then the next day, we're going to write two songs. The next day, we're going to write two songs without sort of examining the process, just whatever comes up. Timmy, bring in some ideas. I'll bring in some ideas. Like just kicking around ideas. Then at the end of a couple of weeks, we had the bones for about 10 or 12 songs that everybody was excited to come in and rock. Then we listened back to those, and you know, Chuck could say, I'm really feeling the verse of this one. B could say, this, I've got a hook that goes with that. When we started crafting the songs, but the initial, to see whether or not we could do it, took one day. In my mind, it took one day. That first day we wrote two songs, I was excited to come back the next day and try two more.
There was a time where, and it was times, I should say, when Tim, Brad, and Tom, the three of them would be in the rehearsal room in the stage, and they would have this little kind of hidden triangle, right? And they would just play to each other, and the shit was banging, and then they were like, I'm like, what the fuck are they talking about? How was that undope? Like,
that one sounded pretty good.
Right? And then they go and do it again, and I didn't notice the difference. I'm like, I got things to learn here.
I was curious about for the Rage Core here, for the, you three guys, you've done so many different things. You played as Audio Slave. You've played in many different configurations. Now you're doing something that, while not purely Rage, is more back in a Rage mode. How did all the other stuff you've done affect the way you came back to this mode?
That's what it's all about for me. Yeah. You know, it's all about getting better as a musician, being able to like figure out the puzzle, you know, the song's sort of like a puzzle and you just unlock it, you know, and like we start, like Tom was saying, it could be anything that would be an inspiration that any one of us could bring, and then the song just becomes what it is, and that's a beautiful thing about what we're doing. I sort of lost my train of thought.
So like with your previous, like Whack Rat and stuff, like how does the other things you've done feed in to the
Audio Slave is a band, sorry, that I
thanks, Tom.
I definitely hear in this band. I hear those chord progressions that you could sing over that we never did with Rage, ever. And to be able to do and play that kind of music in a huge, gnarly kind of way is a challenge in itself, you know, and I feel like we did that, you know, and I'm proud of it. And when I hear the songs, sometimes, believe it or not, I do think of Chris Cornell and what I learned from that guy and that sort of thing.
Yeah, Tim, I actually remember I did an Audio Slave story back when you guys first formed. I remember you saying that one of the things you learned in that scenario was just like sometimes you'd be playing a bass note and it's like, no, that doesn't work with the vocal melody.
Yeah.
Whereas before, it was like the James Brown theory. Like everything hits on the one, and like in the four record catalog of Rage Against the Machine, I don't think there's a chord. I don't think there's two chords to one song. We would struggle
with that. People would say that, and we'd be like, okay. And we did parts. We had parts where we moved the bridge and just played like one note a few times, and then went back. You know,
and those parts never really worked though.
It's sticking cool on the when one you is feel right. like you get to move around musically, and you don't really know it. You know, you think like I hear people go, oh, it sounds like Rage. But it really doesn't. Like on a musical level, it's way different.
It's much more chordal and a step with the next evolution. At the same time, the riffs are there. Yeah. You're still
thank goodness, riff master. Thank goodness the riffs are there. I mean, from the very first rehearsal, Tim and Brad and I played together. There's a certain, it's like an elasticity to what we. There's a heaviness and an elasticity to what we play, which I think separate in whether it's Rage or Audioslave or Prophets of Rage separates us from the way that other bands play rock that has funky elements to it.
Brad, did the experience of playing with Sabbath give you anything that you brought to this?
Well, it was interesting doing that because there's actually a lot of Sabbath influence in Rage Against the Machine. So to go back and be work with those guys who, you know, I was sitting at 14 with a record player trying to be Bill Ward and trying to learn these riffs was awesome, and just to see how they work was actually a really great experience. As well, like a lot of people don't know I did this. I actually played with Smashing Pumpkins for a while. And for me as a drummer, it was like one of my best moments, because I feel like I became a better drummer learning. Like I played to Gish. That was like the last record I sat in my room and played to probably before I stopped like sitting in my room playing to records all the time. So to go back and like look at Jimmy Chamberlain and go, oh shit, now I gotta really like play this shit. The guy is phenomenal. And so to really get in that guy's head and understand what he's doing but still bring my own thing to it was a heavy task that I didn't even know that I was going to be able to do. Anyway, so it was interesting to do that. I feel like I became a better drummer both making the Black Sabbath record and doing the Smashing Pumpkins thing. Lo and behold, bringing that to Prophets of Rage, you're always learning. So I feel like it definitely helped with Prophets of Rage.
And the three of you now have a history that's unlike really any other band. This is your third configuration together. Obviously, there's something that really works about these three people, and it's movable, interestingly, to other scenarios.
Yeah, I say that all the time. The three of these guys come together, they look at each other in the eye, and there's something that comes out of that that you just can't explain. It just was like ordained by the whatever the that energy is, and it comes out.
One of the tracks that was a nice surprise is Legalize Me. Mm. Perhaps the message was not a surprise given that Be Real is in this band, but but musically it's a, and let's hear a little bit of right now. How did that song come together? Because it does have a nice different feeling to it.
It was Brendan O'Brien produced this record, who we've had a lot of excellent history working with in the past. And Brendan, who's been sober for 30 some years, one day in the midst of I had 10 songs, worked up to record for the record. And one day Brendan says, "You guys need a song about weed." And I just thought he was joking. He's like, "I'm dead serious. You got to Be Real in the pen. People expect this sort of thing." I'm like, "Really?" He's like, "Yeah, write a song about weed." And we're like, Brendan never, that's not a thing that he normally says. And so over the course of the next couple of days, we worked up a song in the studio. Be Real wrote some particularly potent Be Real lyrics to it, and then we put our twist on it, which was we can tell you what the twist that came in the lyrics on that, so it's not just about weed.
It's a transfer of energy, if you will. It goes from this good time, feel good thing, and then it gets into this dark place musically, which is, it grabs you right when you get it. And Chuck D delivers this part of the song that's it's the driving part, lyrics written by Mr. Tom Morello here.
Not the weed ones.
I wrote the weed ones. And, it was something that I hadn't planned to do for the group. Originally I had planned to stay hardline on the things that we had written previous to this song. And then, the scenario of a weed song was brought.
It was demanded of you.
Yes, it was demanded of me.
You have to be who you are.
So I obliged, but we put a twist on it. In the beginning, it was basically, hey, listen, legalization's here, and we're still fighting for it. The fight continues, and let's celebrate it. But the fight continues, and in the path of the song, the seriousness comes about it, though. The things that are going on in the world that that we're pretty much addressing through the whole album, Chuck delivers on this piece, and it gives you all these scenarios that are going on in the world,
and just the fuckery of government legislation and government doing this, the cluster bombs, all that type of talk inside that verse,
what is illegal, but also who is illegal, from the immigrant issue here to the refugee crisis overseas. It's legalize me. It's not necessarily the weed speaking to you, legalize me. It's also all of those who people who are often considered illegitimate humans just because they don't have some sort of status.
The dreamers,
for sure.
And it took on a different meaning, after we actually recorded the song, and I like to think that it captures a light side and a dark side of what we're dealing with, it's a very unique song in comparison to the rest of the album because it does have a lighter side to it.
But then it goes dark, yeah.
But then it goes dark.
Another, I think, great showcase for what this band is capable of is Living on the 110. Chuck, maybe you could talk about how that one came together. And let's hear a little bit of it first, and then Chuck will talk about it.
Wonderfully penned by my man B Real, and basically it spoke to And he can speak on it even better than me, but I'm such a fan of the song. It's my favorite song on the album, if I had to pick a favorite. Los Angeles and Skid Row, and there's a city underneath a city, and which is the largest concentrated homeless population in North America. And it's Skid Row and all the adjacent areas. And the 110 is that highway, because of Southern California, you could kind of live outside without the elements, you know, killing you like in other parts of this country. And the 110 provides us a roof. And on top, as people have their Bugattis, is that what their car is, Bugatti?
Bugattis, Lambos, yeah. Porsches. Yeah. You know,
and while they're in traffic on the top of the 110, underneath you got a city of homeless people who are so it's a stark contrast. Matter of fact, you can look at the 110 and see the top layer and the bottom layer all in the same eyesight. And my man B Real covered it fantastically in a couple of verses that say it all.
And how about Who Owns Who, another great track?
Give it to Timmy C for actually being the master of lyric arrangement and truncation. Go ahead. Because, matter of fact, he would drill it into us. Like, I think that, go ahead, tell it to me. I think this could be a little concise.
I like hearing you tell it, but that, you know, it's like, but I.
You're getting off at it, right?
So, Chuck, tell me more how great I am. The great thing I did.
It feels uncomfortable for me to say anything, but I just, like I said, I've said it before, and it's, we don't have, there's not insecurities in the room that are impeding us right now, and I hope there never is, because that's where you get the most done. And I was hearing things with all everyone's things, and I was speaking up about it, and the same was reciprocated. And that is, if you're going to get into a band, which I think, yeah. I don't think it matters if you make millions of dollars and play for 100,000 people a night, or whether or not you're just in the living room with your bros, serious about it, making music. Like, it's a blessing. It doesn't come around that often. It really doesn't.
Yeah, and you know, we checked our egos at the door pretty much, you know.
And a lot of people say that too, right, B? Yeah, a lot of people say, oh, we have to check our egos at the door.
But we actually did it. You know, yeah. We allowed, I think all of us allowed ourselves to be open to each other's ideas and suggestions, to where if Chuck and I didn't necessarily have an idea, you know, Timmy or Tom or even Brad could come and say, what about this? And we would actually try it and consider it and see where it went. And a lot of great things came about that way. You know, for instance, the Legalize Me song. You know,
and the Who Owns Who.
And the Who Owns Who. Timmy's idea, you know, and with some of the other songs that Chuck and I wrote, you know, we had suggestions from Tim or Tom on changing certain lines or a certain delivery on it. And I think being open like that, it allowed us to be an actual team.
Yeah, it's a real band. Yeah.
And we all have our roles, but we all had each other's backs in the sense that we want to make the song better. You know, and if there's any way we can do that, let's be open to it. And fortunately, not like a lot of bands, you know, we were able to do that, you know, and because with hip hop, it's slightly different. You can't really, as a producer, you know, most of the time, they don't tell each other, okay, change this line or change that line. You sort of just let the rapper go. And whatever he does is what he does. As long as it's on beat and on point and delivered properly, cool. But, you know, it's not necessarily ever are we given the direction from a producer in our field. So, you know, to be able to get the direction from Brendan O'Brien, get the direction from Timmy C., Tom, Brad, or Lord, or Chuck,
man. And get the direction from B-Real, who basically said, we ain't got to spit like, you know, Attack of the 50-foot woman versus, you know.
it just made it easy and organic, and the process just, it was like nothing I've ever experienced, and I think that's why we were able to come up with the material that we did in such short time, and, you know, we were confident about what we put out because we just felt like this was a great representation of what we can do together. And it's just the beginning.
In the few minutes we have left, I wanted to briefly address the political situation. It's interesting to sit in a room with people who in many ways were ahead of this time politically. Chuck was talking about things decades ago that some people are just catching up with. Many young people are now moving in a political direction that Tom and you guys have been suggesting for some time. So, it must be nice in some level that people seem to be catching up. On the other hand, where Donald Trump is the president of the United States. So how do you see this? I know it's painful to even say it, but how do you guys see this moment?
You have to look at it like this. The moment is what it is. So it's what you make of the moment. And my hope is that the Trump-Pence regime brings into existence the movement that not only dethrones it, but the movement that really makes for a more just and decent country. And that's, the current two-party system, there's not a lot of room for that. And it's, there's a lot of corporate control and big money control of all politicians. Take it for somebody who worked for a U.S. senator for 2 years. That's the way of it. But that's a different kind of way of changing the world than the huge anti-fascist march in Boston. The huge women's march, people standing up against this kind of rise of neo-fascism. And our music, this record is our audition to be the soundtrack for the resistance.
Chuck, very quickly, how do you balance the idea that, at least in my opinion, Trump is a unique danger with the fact that there's these broader problems that you see in the political system and in the, sort of the consciousness of this country?
We didn't wish for the world to be this fucked up in order for us to be a band. We was going to find 12 topics that we were going to hone into. It's just that this is like lowest hanging fruit under the belt line that allows us to talk about and rock the obvious. So here we are.
So this has been Rolling Stone Music Now. We've been here with Prophets of Rage. Thanks so much, guys. We'll be back next week, and their album comes out September 15th. I'd be remiss in mentioning Tom Morello.
Thanks, Gene.
And so we'll be back next week at 1 p.m. on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, download us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe to us as a podcast. And please leave a nice review on iTunes if you can, and we'll see you next week.